Good evening, everybody, and welcome to our regular Monday stream.
Hello.
Hello.
Just to get off the bat, the weather's crap today. The weather's going to be crap all week.
Yeah.
Sorry, we don't have much else to really
For those
that.
Hoping for our England weather reports, Lord, oh Lord, it be raining.
Yeah.
And it be raining quite a lot.
And we didn't even get like proper thunderstorms over the weekend, which was pish.
It was a bit pish, yes. slightly pish on our part. But we will soldier on through the mediocre, rather muggy weather.
There we go.
We've added some adjectives there for the person that comments on our weather reports.
No, we're dwindling viewers. Enough weather reports. We need to carry on the other stuff.
Anyway, welcome. welcome returning viewers and new viewers alike. I see you. Here's the unique in the chat there. I see a few other people who are regulars. So welcome. If you guys are looking to support us in any way, we tend to do a bit of a preamble. We ask to monetize somehow.
So you can do the super chats or the super stickers. But if you do not want to give whatever the Pajit guy that runs YouTube is now any money, you can support us on the Ko-fi or Ko-fi or however you pronounce it.
Yes.
Which the link has decided to scrap the shit of the bed because you've got the username for the channel in it.
Oh, no, it's fine.
But just copy that link there that is the pinned comment in the chat if you wish to donate to us, and we'll read that out during the course of the stream or on the next one if it comes in after, which it can do sometimes.
Yes.
Other than that, we have stuff on the Substack that you can go and read if you wish to.
Yes.
We have recently put up a number of pieces on the YouTube as well that are readings of some of the Substacks, which people seem to be rather enjoying, because now that you're putting them out like anywhere between 18 months to 2 years later, they've become extremely relevant.
Yeah, it seems that the Substack just seems to become really, really relevant like 2 years after we've written it.
Yes, so. And also at the same time, I'll be putting out some short pieces on the Mantras for Surviving Modernity, which is again a stream that where people seem to enjoy. So
yes,
keep a lookout for those. We'll try and have at least one of those out a week. I should be able to get another two written at some point this week.
Let me double check on YouTube. It just looks like the chat is completely broken. So my apologies if it is. Let me just make sure I've got the desktop audio on, so you're not completely getting it in the ear twice.
If the chat is borked, the link to support us is in the description for the stream.
Yes, it is. I can't quite tell if it has or it hasn't, but yeah, it says error, try again.
Oh, so, no!
Thank you, YouTube. You seem to have destroyed our chat, but we will soldier on. Apologies to people watching the replay. That's why the chat stopped, because YouTube seems to have shat the bed a little bit.
I don't know. I would half suggest if people have possible questions through the stream, and they are the sort of people that may or may have not already DM me on Twitter, feel free to shoot some over, because the chat seems to be basically dead, and I do like a little bit of chat interaction every once in a while.
As do I, but that's a bit of a shame. We're seeing some hearts go up, but and hundreds, but we can't see any chats at the moment, so yeah, sorry about that, guys.
I suppose in that instance then, we'll get cracking on here, because again, we've got quite a bit here, but I think in the way that I've structured the notes for the stream today, it's not the end of this arc, as it were.
It's the end of this little mini arc. If you're watching the VOD of this and you haven't seen them, I'd actually suggest going back and watching Henry Jackson Society and Policy Exchange ones, because we've talked about in detail exactly how the Conservative Party and moneyed interests like the Gates Foundation are directly infiltrating our spaces with people who are their operatives. It is very, very clear there's a clear pipeline, and it's very clear you shouldn't trust people who come from this quagmire. It's a very, very basic thing, and we've been talking about at the beginning of every one of these streams, it's a very basic thing that you shouldn't be able to have your enemies fund people who appear on your platform.
No.
You shouldn't have that pipeline there where the people who are your basically sworn political enemies from their point of view as well should not be able to influence your movement, influence your alternative media outlets. They shouldn't be able to influence what you do.
Yes.
But they can, and they very, very clearly can.
Well, yeah.
As I mentioned off air, you can't have a revolt against...
Back.
Yeah, you can't have a revolt against the establishment.
We back. Yes. Refresh. Maybe it'll work. But no, because I put the sort of top line here that we'll be continuing on from last week's stream, and we shall continue to discuss how the Tory enemy is in our midst, and more specifically, what appears to be a technocratic operation of narrative management. And I don't want to be like, you're going to want to stick around because there's some juicy stuff coming, but like, some of the examples we have found of a certain individual are so egregious that it makes it very difficult for us not to question the authenticity of some of the people in our spheres. And again, we mean this in no ill will or want to create drama or anything like that, but at the end of the day, if we don't put what we're going to put in this next sort of, hopefully no more than 90 minutes worth of stream, no one will ever know about it.
No. It's also a very, again, we must remove the Tory boys in our midst. We must cast out those who have moneyed interests and personal history collaborating with this party machine that has spent 13 years systematically helping the rest of the elite class, the global elite class, destroy Britain.
Yes.
I if you are somebody who's not on board with the idea that the Conservative Party is completely evil, then I suggest you go back and watch maybe some of AA's earlier content, some of our earlier content. Because the Parliamentary Conservative Party is very clearly an enemy of the British people, and it does all it can to forestall action on the issues it pretends to care about. And we'll see that in detail here. We'll see a lot of people ask, why aren't there political parties that represent kind of the real opinions of real British people? There's been this gulf, really since the 1980s, between what polling says people want and what political parties represent. And what we're finding here is a part of that puzzle. We're seeing, we know the why, but we're seeing the how.
Yes,
this is part of how anyone to the right of the Conservative Party is hobbled.
And a lot of very specific instances, also the who.
Yes.
Shall I sort of just read through some of the starting stuff here and you can kind of click through the links as we go?
We'll first of all be talking about Tim Montgomery and Unheard.
Yes.
Because a lot of people, as you know, don't seem to know who Unheard is for, but we'll get to that. We've actually managed to answer the question of who Unheard is for.
But we'll get there in due time. Tim Montgomery, who we briefly mentioned last week, was the co-founder for the Centre of Social Justice in 2004.
Yes.
Alongside Ian Duncan Smith, career Tory and once suffering leader of the opposition party during Blair's reign.
Yes.
One Carl Alan Mark Forman, merchant banker, educated at the London School of Economics and a long-term foreign aid magnate that has worked with all sorts of interesting people. And he would also happen to be the non-executive director of the Home Office as of 2018, which I thought was a little interesting. And then lastly, we have Baroness Stroud, who is the current chief of the Legatum Institute think tank, which focuses on social progress via education, which we'll bring back up soon in a moment. So we can see that this is the sort of people that Tim Montgomery was surrounded with. These are the people he was engaging with. It's worth noting as well, of course, that the Centre for Social Justice is credited with its help on developing universal credit, a policy we all know to be basically a stepping stone to UBI.
Yes. Sorry, I didn't have it on screen. That's Tim Montgomery. He is a co-founder of the Centre for Social Justice. We talked about last week, it is the think tank that was Ian Duncan Smith's entire kind of era in opposition. It really came up with a lot of the, as you mentioned, universal credit and modern slavery.
And the Modern Slavery Act one is interesting as well, because those who understand policy, and especially those who watched the performative failure stream from the other week, the Modern Slavery Act, which allows migrants to claim they were trafficked in order to seek legal citizen status, and it allows us to think back to that stream and how they are talking about an illegal immigration bill. Well, from 2015 onwards, the Centre for Social Justice has been formulating policy that allows them to create quote-unquote legal routes.
Yes. So Tim Montgomery is someone who was involved in also very much the Compassionate Conservative Project.
Yes. I mean, it's, if you want to go to the Independent link, that's the next one there. It's an interesting thing because Montgomery himself...
Yeah, it is also just literally called the Centre for Social Justice, which is funny. But Tim Montgomery's been involved in a lot of different things. Like I said, he worked for the Times. He was a member of the Conservative Party, but he threw his toys out the pram over Brexit, or apparently.
If you scroll down a little bit here in this, you'll see that it's in the 1990s. Back up a little bit more than that.
Yes, early life.
Christian Conservative Christian Fellowship in December 1990 that him and one of his mates started when they were at Exeter University. But if we then go to the Independent article from 2012,
yes,
remember this is the time of David Cameron.
This is the heyday of compassionate conservatism, i.e., Blairism, and also them all performed to the falling over each other to be like gay marriage people. Yes,
and this is obviously all in vain and in time with Policy Exchange and the sort of core group of people that revolved around that that brought all the progressive policy into the Conservative Party in that period.
Yes.
Just from the second paragraph there.
But I want to stress, if you didn't watch one last time, I want to stress that the Centre for Social Justice is just an extension directly of the Tory party.
Yes.
It is just the Tory party creating some policy. And Tim Montgomery, as we will keep seeing, is a very, very well-entrenched Tory insider. As we'll get to with Conservative Home as well. But this is him basically trading in his early years on his credibility as kind of a hard-edged member of the Conservative Party in like a Christian conservative sense. And as soon as it gets to 2012, it's Cameron time. It's time for all of the, you know, all of the ideology or the actual beliefs, or at least the stated beliefs, to be put away in favor of the adults are back in the room. We are the left conservatives now.
Yeah. I was just saying, can you go back to the... Because I did want to read the paragraph from that.
This one?
The independent one that we had.
Oh, sorry about that. let me reopen that one, sorry.
Yeah, just the second paragraph. In an interview with The Independent, Tim Montgomery dismissed criticism that that extending equal rights to gays and lesbians would weaken marriage. He said Tories and church leaders should support gay marriage because it would save the institution, not destroy it. Marriage is probably the most important conservative institution, and excluding people from it is therefore excluding people from conservatism to a significant extent.
It's such mental gymnastics in that sentence. That is amazing. You know what? I'll put that in its entirety in the chat for posterity, because that sentence is just a real indicator of the death of the Conservative Party.
Yes.
It's very... Again, this person was involved in the leadership of the Conservative Party. He wrote speeches for Ian Duncan Smith.
Mm.
He is somebody who was head of Conservative Home, as we'll get to. And he also founded Unheard. Where the pieces are starting to... It's amazing that this doesn't get mentioned. People are like, wow, Unheard's full of shite. This is why Unheard is full of shite.
Montgomery seems to have followed the Cameronite line of the Tory party. It appears as at some point as well that he worked alongside those at Policy Exchange. Merely this seems in a sort of presenting role in a partnership with Conservative Home, because, of course, there's a link between the think tank and the media outlet that signal boosts the think tank content.
Yeah, yeah.
However, if you try and find some of this stuff, a lot of the links have just kind of been scrubbed. I mean, I think that's the next link we've got here is like, him that's meant to be doing some meeting with Tim Montgomery. I presume this is one you've gone back and saved somewhat.
Yes.
Right, fair enough. Because I was trying to look up some of these earlier on. I was getting dead links. But there you go. There's him with Nick Bowles, who we covered last week, discussing a square deal on housing.
Yes.
You've got another one here as well, where Tim Montgomery leaps, others will follow from CapEx, I believe it is, which is another, like, Conservative Home media outlet that's essentially just attached to the Tory party.
Yes, it is. It's interesting that he's talked about in such kind of glowing terms. CapEx, by the way, is just the publication arm of a think tank called...
The Centre for Policy Studies.
Yes, the Centre for Policy Studies. I always get these ones.
David Cameron's other favourite think tank.
Well, it's the...
Or is this Jeremy Hunt's favourite think
tank? I believe this is the old Thatcher one they've repurposed.
Yes.
Because this very much is unapologetically just the Tory party. I mean, look at the cover image. It's just all Tory MPs.
It's Sajid Javid. The CPS plays a very important part in X.
Yes.
Comres think tank as well. That's interesting.
Well, how to tax families... Fair.
Oh, Jesus. Of course, it's a black family
the archetypal
as well.
British family, yes. But I just wanted to read this little bit. Where is it here? I'm on the right one this time.
Yeah.
There it is, sorry. His current project, The Good Right, seeks to define and promote a form of compassionate conservatism. There's that word again. That's the Cameronite word. That is unafraid to speak with a moral heart that, while unashamedly pro-capitalist, demands capitalists act virtuously and that sees a positive role for government. You could describe it as the Tory party for the little guy. That entire sentence, so it's Blairism. It's Bidenomics. It's the Clinton administration. It's neoliberalism. It's so amazing that this sentence exists and the previous sentence exists about the bringing gay people into the conservative institution of marriage and therefore conservatizing the gay community by marrying them is just, yeah, wicked, wicked, wicked people. But again, people are asking what the fuck is Unheard, but Unheard is a supposedly dissident outlet that gets shared a lot in these circles. And the problem with that is, yes, you can just not read it, but it is used for the legitimacy of these people.
This is the thing we're discussing here, is not just about, you know, oh, this person talked to this person. What we are mapping out is the wide scale sort of aspects of a long-winded narrative manufacturing operation. Now, I know that's a bit of a word salad, but at the end of the day, it's the only way to talk about this stuff, because that's how they have talked about it, and that's what we need to sort of go through here to make
sense
of it all.
Don't worry, we'll be explaining why all of this is relevant.
Yes, but Montgomery himself founded Conservative Home, which you're on just now, in 2005, much like CapEx, which is merely an extension of the Centre for Policy Studies, one of the older Tory think tanks.
The Conservative Home is just an extension of the Conservative Party.
Yes. So in a sense, Conservative Home and CapEx exist really as just nothing more than a front for grooming fresh media meat into the Tory party machine.
Yes.
Then, in 2017, Tim Montgomery goes on to found Unheard, the now infamous post-liberal outlet that has invested whole cloth in nonsense like the TERF versus TRA debate, and uses numerous polls, and they talk about this on their website as well, that they specifically engage in crafting stories that have some form of capture with one type of audience or another, so that they can directly influence that specific subset of people.
It's the battle over breastfeeding.
Yes.
Women's are pawns in the contraceptive war.
No.
The plot to redefine conversion therapy. It's all Guardian articles with a slightly different bent to them.
Now, what I find quite interesting as well, if we go to, not this one, but the next one, the Press Gazette link,
yes,
scroll down to the screenshot there.
Yes.
Keep going a little bit, it's the screenshot Twitter.
Yeah.
Now, Tim Montgomery seems to he decides to leave Unheard in 2018. And he goes on to say, you know, I wish the team every success in the months ahead. The aim of building a site where diverse and neglected voices gather is a noble one. Now, to me, that reads like he is stepping back from Unheard because, one, he set it up, two, he's put a load of people in charge, and three, it gives them more of a slightly grassroots, edgier public image when, at least directly on their website, there's no reference to a man that's been involved in the Tory party since the 1990s.
Unheard is a Tory party project. If Tim Montgomery founds it, it is a Tory party project.
Yes.
He, like I said, he directly worked with government, writing speeches in the think tanks. He's come through all these places we talked about last time. He is the consummate Tory insider. He is the consummate David Cameron compassionate conservative. He is the consummate surrenderite on all the cultural issues. And yet here he is founding one of the supposedly biggest dissident news outlets in the world, effectively.
Yes.
I know a lot of people haven't heard of it. But
it seems to be a massively influential outlet amongst the anti-woke types on Twitter, which is exactly what we're talking about.
It's also used to create this large sense of legitimacy.
Yes.
In this
and
world.
I think also very much follows in vain with something we've talked about before in a certain group called Democracy 3.0.
You will see a lot of the campaigns being pushed on Twitter right now
are all on this page.
Are all coming through this somehow.
And if we just scroll up briefly to the about, we're just on the about section, they're talking about down one more, just with the bloke that's there. Oh, yeah. Andrew Hawkins. Now, I mentioned it before, but I'll just mention it again. Andrew Hawkins was from Comres, who we had mentioned in that Centre for Policy Studies as well,
earlier,
which was a massive lobbying group that saw massive elevation during the Blair era, where this whole, you know, pressure group, opinion poll, influence and governance sort of whole thing arose.
Yeah.
So the fact that he's working with the sort of people who would be writing articles on Unheard,
yes,
to have this whole fake grassroots front for online democratic action, it all fits together all too bloody well.
A lot of these campaigns seem to be hot button ones that come from articles in all the places we've been talking about.
The Daily Skeptic, the Free Speech Union, which of course some of the folk we'll be getting to are all members or advisors to as well. There's a little bit as well, if we want to do the last little bit on Unheard, where you looked up Paul Marshall, who's one of the big investors.
First of all, I want to go through very quickly some of the stuff we have here.
Cool, we could do that
first. We've talked about kind of the Tory octopus. All of these, Conservative Home, the Henry Jackson Society, the Centre for Social Justice, the CAPEX and its parent think tank, I can't remember its name.
The Centre for Policy Studies.
The Centre for Policy Studies and Policy Exchange. Oh God, they're so interchangeable. Are all just, not even like wink, wink, nudge, nudge. They are all just parts of the Conservative Party.
Yep.
But you will find these outfits and these outlets, and I'm kind of lumping Unheard a little bit in with these as well. It's not quite as close, but it's getting there. A lot of people in our sphere have these on their CV.
Yes.
If you see the Centre for Social Justice, if you see if you see published in CAPEX and Conservative Home, if you see Henry Jackson Society Policy Exchange, any of these places, you are seeing the Tory Party.
Yes.
And the fact that this isn't known in our circles is quite worrying, because you should not be having people who are actively being paid by these organisations on any platform if you want to be quote-unquote dissident or alternative or against the current regime, because you can't have an anti-regime movement.
No.
It doesn't work.
You cannot subvert the Tory Party. The Tory Party will subvert you. And that must be a guiding principle.
Yes, the octopus has arrived. But you will find there's daughter organisations and different relationships here, but another important aspect of how this works is this is how the Tory Party manufactures credibility and CVs for people.
Because that leads into the next point. Can we just quickly go over this one? Because it's the sort of end of the Unheard stuff, and we can go back to that.
Yeah, I'm just saying, keep that in mind, though.
Yes. You wanted to look at, I believe it's the political section of the page belonging to Paul Marshall.
We've talked about Tim Montgomery. Tim Montgomery is the founder. He's the brain, really, behind the idea of what Unheard is. But Paul Marshall is the money.
Yes.
He's the money man. He is Unheard's sole investor. Is its sole shareholder
from its something like that.
From its company's house listing?
I'm sure we'll find if we scroll down.
But it basically just says political affiliations. Between 2002 and 2015, Marshall donated £200,000 to Liberal Democrats. Huh, what happened during that period? He left the party in 2015 over its policies on the European Union and its support for continuing British membership. People forget, but during the halcyon days of the coalition government, the Liberal Democrats were kind of groomed as a strange semi-libertarian party for Guardian readers who couldn't quite stomach voting Labour anymore. In July 2016, Marshall donated £3,250 to Michael Gove's Conservative campaign. In 2017, he gave funding, and he basically is all the financial backing to political news site Unheard. He is financially Unheard via their company's house.
He's the only sole outside source of money that we at least know about. He gives another £500,000 to the Conservative Party itself.
Yes.
And then invests in a personal capacity £10 million into GB News. And also, I believe, replaced Andrew Neil as chairman of the channel following Neil's resignation in 2021.
We've found the money behind a lot of this. This, like, Unheard, GB News, it's people like Paul Marshall.
Was it not somewhere as well, somewhere up in the earlier section of this, that this guy gets like some silly amount of money from the Open Society, from George Soros, to start one of his businesses as well?
We'll go over that in a sec. But yeah, I just wanted to do the joke of, look, we figured it out, guys. We found it. We found who Unheard is for.
Yes.
Unheard is specifically for Tim Montgomery and Paul Marshall. That's it.
I hadn't seen that yet. That's great.
Those two people read Unheard and go, oh, yes, this is amazing. This is perfect. Yeah. Perfect.
Everyone go send that to A on Twitter. Take a quick screen cap.
Well, yeah, everybody do send this to the carpet merchant, because we've done it. We've cracked
worked it out.
We've worked it out. Unheard is for Tim Montgomery and Paul Marshall and nobody else. mercy. Anyway, I'll go back to the octopus in a second, but yes, it's
he's founder and chairman of Marshall Wallace LLP, one of Europe's largest hedge fund groups. Wallace was founded in 1987 by Marshall and Ian Wace. At the time, Marshall Wace is one of the first hedge funds in London. The company started with $50 million, half of which was from George Soros.
Ba ba ba. The money behind Unheard and GB Newland.
Prior to the founding Marshall Wace, Marshall worked for Mercury Asset Management, the fund management arm of S.G. Warburg & Co. We all the way back to democratization just like that.
We're back. Those of you who know your onions will be having a good chuckle right now.
But anyway, as you've said, conservative home, CapEx, all these different outlets, they are a way for creating credibility amongst certain individuals, and that this credibility is used to have these rising stars who influences on these very specific issues. And I know we focused a little bit on Calvin Robinson last week, but for the sort of extended period for the rest of the stream, I want to heavily look over a man called Matthew J. Goodwin. Now we'll start here with what is a little profile from him on the Legatum Institute website.
I always thought that said Legume Institute, like it was a bean.
Which was, as mentioned earlier on, run by Baroness Stroud, who was part of the Centre for Social Justice, which was set up by Tim Montgomery and all these other people.
So this is a related, basically this is a sequel think tank to the Centre for Social Justice,
and
in a way.
I really want to focus on the crafting and management of narratives. And we shall do so through the work of Matthew J. Goodwin, who now seems to be lauded in our own bloody dissident circles, and I cannot for the life of me understand why, because if we scroll down to his little profile here, now this is an announcement that he's going to
I'll quickly get up. Some of you probably follow this guy.
And you, the other ones of you who aren't have probably seen me like hate, quote tweet him, because
he's somebody who does like the dissident media tour, let's say. It's somebody who's been on a lot of the different outlets, who's been talking like he's somebody who is quote unquote based promoting his novel Values, Voice and Virtue, which is really just a rehashing of five previous other novels that all say the same thing
to a certain extent.
From not even just from him, but anyway, Matt Goodwin, he's kind of our little case study for today of the Tory boys in our midst, anyway.
But on that Legatum one, it's got a little description.
This is really difficult to get on stream for some reason.
What
an awful website here.
And this is from them launching their Centre for UK Prosperity in 2021, supposedly. The centre will be directed by Professor Matthew Goodwin. Matthew, who will join the Institute full-time in January 2021, is Professor of Political Science at the University of Kent, and Associate Fellow at Chatham House.
Yes.
He's conducted research for nearly two decades, much of which is focused on left behind in low income communities. Not true. And we'll get on to that. I think we go on to the next link here as well, which is another.
Yes.
Sorry, I know I'm doing loads of pointing.
There's
a profile of him on their page, just for a bit of prosperity show, the fact that they were going to have this bloke on, and they've got their descriptions of him, and this, that, and the next thing, but that never came to be, because you try and look on the Legatum website for any sign of this man, and none exists. Because what actually happened was he was appointed to the Social Mobility Commission by the Women and Equalities Minister, Liz Truss, along with seven other people.
For those of you who don't know, and we're going to have to do a little bit of kind of history here, the Social Mobility Commission started back all the way with Labour's whole child poverty thing.
Yes.
This is basically full-spectrum Blairite dominance still existing within Westminster, because this is something that the Conservative government is continuously forced to do by Blairy legislation that, for some reason, they refuse to repeal.
They perpetuate it to an extent that, as I've written here, it is a continuation project from the Blair era to enshrine in law a procedure, a backstop, so that any level of benefits or universal credit that some of these people have already worked on cannot be wound or rolled back or lessened. That it's now like a minimum standard, and to try and go backwards on that is, you know, some sort of heinous misdoing. What I found interesting as a little aside is just some of the people that are on this commission with Matt Goodwin.
Yeah, sorry.
Because I've got them, they should be the next set of links here. One doctor...
Well, I just want to get them. Is there a list of them here?
Yes, there is. Scroll down.
Where?
There you go. There's one Dr. Raghib Ali, which will be the next link that's on that. Who is some weirdo epidemiologist Indian bloke, which I find one most interesting. Last sentence, the first paragraph. He was appointed as an independent expert advisor on COVID-19 and ethnicity to the UK government in October 2020. What a very specific role, for which he received an OBE, I remind you.
Huh.
It's interesting, that, isn't it? So there's him. Then there's another woman called Rashim Kotecha. This is just her profile page on the Conservative Friends of India, because it was the first one that came up, of course.
Yes.
Head of Engagement for Women to Win, an organisation co-funded by the Prime Minister to get more women elected to Parliament. Speaks at schools, universities, part of our outreach and exchange. And what was that one at the bottom there as well? Charity working to empower women and educate children in the UK and India. She holds a Bachelor degree in Economics from Cambridge University and has been recognised as one of 100 global emerging capitalists by Rees, funded by the Gates Foundation.
These are this man's co-workers, basically. Yes.
And then we've got this guy, Ryan Henson, CEO of the Coalition for Global Prosperity, which is basically just something that like David Cameron and Penny Mordaunt come up with in like 2018, right as they were about to go, or that Cameron was about to go out, which is basically set up for them a future sort of, what would be the phrase, stowaway place where they can go away and do foreign aid guff. Because that seems to be another aspect of what a lot of these people do.
Yes.
But there's another guy's mentioned, Rob Henderson, who seems to be a bit of a complete nobody and has left the commission for personal reasons. Another interesting character is one Parminder Kohli, who, as far as I can tell, is a VP for Shell.
Yes.
And the lubricants and something else market. But he's essentially the one man in Royal Dutch Shell, the multi-billion pound oil company that's pushing DEI from the inside.
Yes,
he's And the Conservative government, the UK, decided, we need you.
Effectively, yes.
And then the last person is Rob Wilson, who's just like a careerist Tory. I couldn't find much else interesting about that. I'm sure there's loads of scandals if we went and looked it up, but there's only so much we can do. The question I want to ask, though, is, so why would Godwin... Someone who's been on an alternative right-wing media tour, including even the Lotus Eaters, and constantly plays up to dissidents on Twitter, be involved with such a commission, sitting side-by-side with people who are actively our enemies?
Yes, he is on, like, this is the tip of the spear when it comes to the Tory government doing, you know, gay things, as in global American empire things. Mm. It is the Social Mobility Commission. Yes, a lot of the time they are just paid to sit in their hands, but it is kind of a cushy position somewhat where the left members of the Conservative Party can go and do a lot of damage if they feel like it.
Mm.
These are the places where a lot of the worst aspects of Tory managerialism come from, and he is very much in the midst of it currently. But
is that true? He's going to have Matt Godwin on UO tomorrow, because I'm going to have a word if that's the case. Because you think it's bad, it's about to get a whole lot worse, because we're going to go into Godwin's past. His many Routledge published books on the far and extremist right, his time working on polling for Policy Exchange, and his stint at another aspect of Tory Central Command. Chatham House.
Yes.
Now, I think, I can't remember if you mentioned this earlier or not, you know, think of Chatham House not only as just like think tank wonks, but something more akin to, oh, sorry, they're saying sorry, was kidding.
Yeah.
You honestly had me there for a second, I'll be honest. But Chatham House is something more like the Council for Foreign Relations.
It is. It's the UK equivalent of the Council on Foreign Relations.
Do you say something like a working group?
The US delegation to the League of Nations in 1919 went away and created the Council on Foreign Relations. The UK delegation, in the same mould, inspired by the same meetings, went and founded Chatham House. It is the UK direct equivalent of the Council on Foreign Relations, yes. Yes.
Now, Godwin himself received his PhD, next link there,
yes, yes,
in 2007 under a man called Roger Eatwell. Now, Roger Eatwell has been a lifelong studier of fascism, populism. He defines fascism as a syncretic ideology, or synchronetic, sorry. But it's clear that what he has done and spent his life working on since the 70s has been wholly taken back up by Godwin as...
Well,
they published
books together.
Yes.
But he is somebody who very much is the archetypal, quote-unquote, conservative anti-fascist. We don't have time to reach today, but he wrote a very self-congratulatory piece about the fact that large amounts of the British populace have been made politically homeless by the complete removal of by the security state of outlets like the BNP.
Well, yeah, we can look at his little... There's that Battle for Ideas website. It seems to be a great resource because there's just all sorts of stuff written on it.
Yes, yes, there is. This is who he models himself after, anyway.
Yeah, his co-authored most recent book, National Populism, The Revolt Against Democracy, one I believe he wrote with Godwin,
yes,
or Goodwin, however you want to pronounce it, seeks to understand the rise of national populists like Donald Trump and Marine Le Pen, placing emphasis on what he terms the 4 Ds, distrust of political elites, fears about the destruction of national and local communities, and the impact of relative economic deprivation and fears about the future, and de-alignment from major parties. Mainstream parties, especially on the right, have sought to diffuse this wave by adopting populism-lite policies, especially relating to immigration. However, this has tended to legitimise rather than diffuse the populist quest for voice more generally. Far from a passing protest, populism raises major issues around the need for new thinking about democracy in order to cope with polarised societies. So let's, you know, try and paint the bigger picture here. You have Eatwell, a man who's been studying in this sort of stuff since, as they say, the late 70s, whose sole focus has been to say to technocratic politicians, you need to make sure that these populists, these nationalists, these extremists, whatever word he wants to give them, do not go on to facilitate some form of political bloc that can operate independently and on its own.
Yes.
They must either be destroyed, or they must be co-opted, or some element of the two. And then you find that, Godwin and Eatwell, they started some defunct anti-extremist group, with a next link there at the top,
yes,
called the Extremist Project.
We'll go over this in some detail probably at some point, because this has been a fascinating thread on the whole idea of effectively what is the Tory element that tries to delegitimize everyone to the right of the Tories. The Extremist Project was very much part of that. These two were involved in it. It seems to have become defunct pretty quickly, but the only thing it talked about was quote-unquote right-wing extremism. And that's all that, well, it's all really that Goodwin talked about right up until he became a supposed darling of the movements he's been decrying for the last decade. It's been a very odd arc.
Well, especially if we go to some of his early media appearances, like some of his early Guardian articles. This one's from 2012. And it's clear that in a lot of his media appearances... 2009, sorry, is one of the first ones. 2012 was another one I was looking at, apologies. But in a lot of his media appearances in his early years, he's clearly framed as this sort of wise, reasonable right-winger who tasks himself and others with the management of any right-of-centre force that isn't directly in Tory party control.
Yes.
And here's him writing an opinion piece for The Guardian about the BNP. Prejudice is declining, but there is still huge support in Britain for the far right. Don't underestimate their ability to draw votes. That's a warning message.
Yes, it is.
That's him saying the BNP is an uncontrolled force and we need to shut it down. How is this man an ally to anyone that loves their own people in this land?
He's not, as we'll come on to, but it's very, very clear. His entire media profile before he supposedly became a media tour dissident right figure was saying that we were all Nazis.
Well, yeah,
and saying that they need to be destroyed for the good of the mainstream parties.
Yeah, I mean, we can look at the books section on his Wikipedia, unless you want to quickly go over that other extremist one.
Oh, no,
well,
it's just saying a beginner's guide to new groups on Britain's far right. There was just a very funny comment at the end here. Dear sir, very simple question. I've run through your website and noticed that there was zero content about far-left extremism, Trotskyist and communist extreme groups. Despite that, many other university-based think tanks or research groups in extremism don't seem to investigate Islamist extremism either, but your website does. Often the university research on extremism are either ideologically or literally affiliated to far-left groups, so are unlikely to investigate them. What is the reason for ignoring the
Thank you, Paul Austin Murphy. Very good question.
But that is the tone of the website. It's very much the only extremism that exists is right-wing extremism.
But if we go to the books section on Matt Goodwin's Wikipedia here, we've got an idea of the sort of books that he's written.
This person is also a conservative government appointee.
Yes.
He's a low-level government appointee. But here's a good point.
I would actually say it's the other way round. I think as the man who he is and the things that he's said and done and been associated with,
yes,
him being appointed to a commission is basically him being appointed to a position of power with zero accountability.
Basically.
I mean, he's got this book, Revolt on the Right. The sparky academic study of the rise of UKIP was selected by The Guardian as one of the best political books of 2014. Was named as Paddy Power Political Book of the Year for 2015.
Oh dear.
Writing in the Financial Times, Kyron Stacey described it as rich in analytical data and containing the occasional anecdotal gem. While in The Spectator, Vernon Bogdanor wrote that this rigorous analysis of the rise of UKIP is the most important book in British politics for years. And he does another one on UKIP and has another one on Brexit and there's the National Populism one he does with Eat Well. And then there's his new book, Values, Voice and Virtue.
Which he went on the media tour. This is where he kind of came to our attention, was
yes,
on the big media tour. GB News, he's on quite a lot. He's been in the Lotus Seats. He's been on all kinds of places, to be fair. But he is somebody who posits himself as somewhat of the champion of the populist now.
Mm.
He is somebody who portrays himself as being anti-woke, especially.
Yeah, I mean, I see someone in chat saying 2014 was a long time ago. He openly criticizes mass immigration. He very carefully chooses his words. He's not going to criticize immigration as a whole because he's put his name behind think tanks that have, for the last 15 years, pushed reasons for why immigration is good.
Yes.
And I'm not willing to hear from people who I know are going to either comment or say in reply to some of the stuff we're putting forward here that, no, what actually happened is Matt Goodwin did all this research and now he's converted, because I'm not buying it.
From what's been said, now you'll see why that's very unlikely in a second.
We're about to get to the smoking gun.
This, when I read this, I was amazed by it.
Yeah, I'm sorry, we'll kind of sped through some of this stuff so we can have a bit of extra time to treat the stuff that's in here, because I actually can't believe I've found this, nor that it's been left lying around for people to find. Because this is like, imagine somebody comes to you with a document that proves everything you've sort of somewhat thought about a certain subset of people for years. I know, okay, I should address the microphone. I'm sure people can still hear me. I see Carl in chat there. This needs to be disseminated through the network. Please, please do.
Well, this is the smoking gun of why these people keep appearing in our spheres, why they keep nominally agreeing with us and then disagreeing with us on larger issues and trying to kind of create this small ideological space to fold people back into the Conservative Party. Because this is just, we'll get into it, really, but this is just the smoking gun of that as a strategy. He actually writes about doing what he's doing now as a political strategy of, quote-unquote, fighting extremism and de-radicalization. But as we know, the Conservative Party, especially its insiders, consider anyone to the immediate right of the Conservative Party, even if the Conservative Party has only just jumped left in the you know, last few weeks, like with the gay marriage issue, as the enemies of the Conservative Party and extremists. So that in this document too is how extremists are defined. I will start with part of the introduction.
Just before you do that, I see Carl's asking a very important question there. Can we make a list of all these guys and have on a PDF or Google Doc of traitors which we can have on bios? One, I wouldn't want to go calling them traitors and putting a name of list together because that gets you in trouble with the wrong people. However, people want the information we've put together as research for these streams, we have it. All you need to do is come and ask.
Anyone who's ever worked with any of these.
Yes.
Basically, we're saying that you need to disconnect yourself from the entire octopus. These are just the Tory party, and you need to separate yourself from them. So you don't even need to do that, because they'll just keep churning out names. Mm. There's a factory that makes these people.
Yes.
So that would be useless, because they'll just replace them. These people are completely interchangeable with each other in many cases.
I mean, the thing here isn't so much, ooh, Matt Galpin's a bad guy. Clearly he is. But he is one of probably numerous other people who hasn't yet been elevated that has done this sort of work. And the PDF we're looking at here, he wrote for Chatham House all the way back in 2011, I believe.
Yes.
Now, the whole framework that this document is written around is how does the establishment and centre-right contain and respond to what's referred to as in here as populist extremist parties.
He deliberately refers to them in every instance as extremists. And he says, it was against this background that Daniel Sachs, CEO of Provitas and chairman of the Daniel Sachs Foundation, I believe he's the policy exchange guy as well, mm-hmm. first contacted me in the spring of 2010, motivated by the upcoming parliamentary elections in Sweden and the rising support for the populist extremist Sweden Democrats. He proposed that Chatham House undertake a project that would examine not only the drivers behind the support of populist extremist parties, but also the possible political responses. So it's very clear that, one, he believes that the Sweden Democrats, who are a relatively mild party, even at this point, are extremists. That they are extremists to be counted and that they are dangerous to democracy. He goes through it in length in this. We don't have time to read the whole thing, but this is the framing. And that he believes that it is his duty to combat them. And he has spent his entire academic life doing this.
Yes.
We've not mentioned it here, but him and his professor are some of the major authors. Do we have that page here at all? Some of the major authors for Routledge books in terms of academic sources for right-wing extremism.
I mentioned Routledge before, and Routledge is who sponsored the Extremist Project website.
Yes, it is.
And Matt Goodwin's work is so prolific that you can search up Hope Not Hate Goodwin and you will find reports from all the way back in 2015 from Hope Not Hate that thank Matt Goodwin. It's bloody Nick Knowles, from Not The House Guy, the DIYOSOS bloke. Sorry, Hope Not Hate Nick Knowles. Basically saying, it's almost a bit of a kind of thankful kind of thing that Matt Goodwin and this other guy have spent years researching UKIP and writing in about detail about how they work, because now us leftists can go and use it to attack them.
We hope to build on the base of this research to explore in greater detail over the coming years both the changing phenomenon of the rise of populist extremist parties and the best avenues for challenging their appeal. To the best of my knowledge, he's never renounced any of this.
No.
He has simply slowly changed the way he communicates. And as this goes on, you will see why.
Yeah. Should we go from sort of page 38 onwards then, and I'll pick out the sections?
Yes, pick out the relevant sections here, if you would. Let me quickly get down to where we were here. I would say, as a kind of a funny aside, he's been commenting on the Sweden Democrats recently in a relatively neutral fashion. But if you go back to his tweets in 2013, he specifically refers to them as the extreme right Sweden Democrats and is talking about
and tags the extremist project
in them. So he is, in 2013, an anti-extremist.
He's calling them terrorists.
Yes. But in 2022, he's on podcasts supposedly defending them.
Scroll down. Look at the little reply tweet. Yeah. I asked Matt Godwin about how one can distinguish between national populism and fascism.
Yes. We also talk about the implosion of the Conservative Party and the space for third party in Britain, about wokeism and what to do about that. It's very clear that all these people know that the Conservative Party, for the time being, is being diminished heavily.
Yes.
And it is their plan to make sure that whatever party gets a little trial run in its meantime, like UKIP did, is able to be folded back into the Tory party, like UKIP was.
Yes.
But again, we will we'll get to that. Page 38?
Page 38.
Okay, cool.
Right, these are what he lists, and this is the biggest section in here, after loads and loads of polling data, which again is almost sort of very cynically written, because he's sort of celebrating the fact that, well, we brought in all these foreigners, 20% of the population doesn't like it, and said 20% has been inundated with performative failure and constant no's to the extent that they are politically homeless. And yes, they essentially take this almost as kind of a win. But the first one I was going to go to here, I believe, starts with, to what extent?
Yes.
You're searching on the wrong page.
Oh, I am searching on the wrong page again. I'm not sure where that is on here, actually. Which section's it in?
It's just throughout the whole responses section I've picked bits out of. Yeah, to what extent? There you go. To what extent is the aptness of a strategy of exclusion supported by the evidence? Now, this is the idea that you just exclude populist extremists.
Yeah.
You know, you just make sure that no one hears of them, no one does anything about it, they don't exist. Contrary to conventional wisdom, research on the relationship between exclusion, levels of support for populist political extremist parties, and their ideological position throws doubts on its effectiveness. One study investigated the impact of exclusion on 8 parties and 10 party systems. Contrary to those assumptions above, it found that parties that were not excluded but were allowed to participate in the wider party system tended over time to move away from more extreme positions.
Yes.
Now that's a very interesting point straight away, that as any political party finds itself in any degree established,
yeah,
it instantly walks back any positions of agitation or hardline positions it had.
Yes.
They just totally fall back on, oh, actually, we're just 1% more than the Tory party or the Labour party or whatever relevant brand of extremism they're engaged in.
Yes.
And then there's another note as well. This one starts from PEPs need to increase.
Which section is it in?
I believe it's under the... I'm not exactly sure what heading it is under. I just know it's under this response section.
What else did it start with again?
PEPs need to increase.
There it is.
Yeah. PEPs need to increase the perceived importance of these issues.
This is under exclusion, though.
Yes.
These are... what they're from the PEPs is populist extremist parties. Mm. So...
if we follow, or sorry, need to increase the perceived importance of these issues in the minds of voters. If we follow this logic, then a second response is for the mainstream parties to attempt to decrease the importance of these issues in the minds of voters.
Yes.
People are worried about immigration, you know, stop them being worried about it.
Stop talking about immigration, yeah.
Or provide some other reason as to why they shouldn't be concerned. This strategy would entail avoiding or downplaying these issues and shifting public attention onto issues which the mainstream party has an advantage. One example would be developing a consensual approach to divisive issues on which PEPs mobilise support, such as
integration policy,
and working across partisan lines to avoid the politicisation of these issues. Like the political switcheroo we saw many months ago.
Yes, what he's talking about here is that the Conservative Party and the Labour Party, or the establishment parties reaching together, holding hands and pretending that immigration is neutral, normal, bipartisan, and we all agree this is the right approach. That what he's saying is creating false consensus here and creating false neutrality. That's what he's saying as a reply to issues like immigration, because... well, the rest of this document is him going through in detail about why these people are angry. And his response is not, we stop doing the things that they hate. His response is this.
Mm.
His response is, here is how we make it so that people buy into the mainstream political parties as a political strategy to get round extremists, in quotes, like the Sweden Democrats, to get round any party that might flank us. This is how we, as the Conservative Party, or we as the mainstream parties, should behave. Why is a man who wrote this document nominally allowed in our circles?
Yeah, why is this, he advertising himself to us?
I would encourage you to read this document because, quite frankly, it's disgusting. I'm dispassionate most of the time about what we read on here. You know, we got through the New Britain stuff. It's terrible, but it's got Gordon Brown's veneer of theory cell, as they said above it. This is somebody who sees the problem, identifies the problem, studies the problem, and says, how do we gaslight people into not seeing the problem? Well, here we go.
I'm trying to remember. I think there's a bit... The one of the whole sections I think we could almost read in full here, seeing as we've got a little bit of time, is just the section on adoption. This, to me, seems like the apex of containment.
Well, the next section...
That comes later on, I think, the next one I've put in there. A third response would see mainstream parties respond by modifying their position on issues such as immigration in an attempt to maximise their support and reduce political space for PEPs. I contain them by crowding them out and adopting their positions rhetorically.
Yes.
Political scientists have long pointed to the strategy of adoption as an attempt by parties to outmaneuver competitors. The underlying logic is as follows. If policy is less important than the pursuit of votes, the logic is you can't beat them, join them. What?
Your mouth's open.
I know, I'm getting a wee bit. Close down the issue space on authoritarian, libertarian dimension by arguing that migration must be limited and multiculturalism tempered by an increase on what some call integration, but others label assimilation. That done, politics can get back to normal.
This is what he's doing. He's doing this. Matt Goodwin has written this as a political strategy that he is now doing. He's being paid to do it by the Conservative Party. He's coming in. He's saying integration. He's saying if the policy is less important than the pursuit of votes, blah, blah, blah. He's basically saying what we do is we go in, we pretend to sort the problems. We change the debate to not immigration, but assimilation integration, which is all the stuff we've seen these think tanks doing. They are reframing the debate towards immigration as integration. They're not talking about the numbers coming. They're talking about, well, if we can assimilate and integrate them, the numbers won't be an issue. That is what the Conservative Party has been doing for the last 13 years.
Yeah.
This is what he has identified, and this is what he is. This is why you can't trust him.
Yeah.
Okay, well, because what he's doing is, he's saying, I'm going to bring you strategies to disrupt what I consider dangerous extremist parties. And my strategy that I'm putting forward here, along with a lot of the others, is what I appear to have done.
Yes.
He has seemed to have taken the adoption line in combating this. Therefore, how even if he claims that he's changed his opinion, how can you trust that? And with a lot of the stuff that he says about immigration and integration, it seems to match. But he is paid by the Tory Party. He's a Tory Party insider, and he's coming to us.
There's more to go. So
yeah. He's coming to us. As a figure, nominally speaking our language, you know, he's on the Lotus, it is on GB News, and he wrote this. It's amazing. It's literally a smoking gun. It's like, this is what they are doing. They have just said it, and I don't think they expected us to find it, to be honest. Go ahead.
For mainstream parties attempting to respond to the rise of PEPs...
Extremist parties,
This might entail adopting more restrictive policies on immigration, tougher measures in law and order, or populist rhetoric. As with the exclusion and diffusing strategies above, adoption presents multiple risks. First, it may damage a party's credibility among voters who may view the shift as the product of political expediency rather than genuine conviction.
Yeah, you must make it convincing.
Second, by switching position on divisive issues such as immigration, a party may inadvertently alienate its base and undermine its electoral prospects. Oh no, what are we going to do? All the businessmen that only vote for us because we bring them cheap labour. Third, the adoption strategy may also inadvertently legitimise the campaigns of populist extremists and bolster their support by increasing the saliency of their core issues. One example was Labour Prime Minister Gordon Brown's pledge to promote British jobs for British workers, which many saw as a cynical attempt to entice back supporters of the BNP, which had previously used the slogan. For parties that never traditionally owned issues such as immigration, it is distinctly unlikely that a sudden shift will convince voters either that they can sincerely care about the issue or that they can deliver a strong performance on it.
Yes.
We'll go to the next one that I've put in the document there.
Well, this one's also great as well. This is very much the Political Insider's Guide principle, yes.
Yeah, and alternatives for mainstream parties to stick to their guns, remain committed to their core principles, and attempt to win debates against PEPs through a strategy of principle. Parties would underscore their existing policies and immigration issues, communicate these policies to voters more effectively, and focus on mobilising their base. Rather than pursue short-term electoral gains, mainstream parties have a duty to prevent the creeping spread of populist extremism and should be prepared, just the next line down there, to bear the costs incurred by a genuine battle against right-wing radicalism, not an ally.
Well, welcome to the enemy space.
So I might get you to read the next one just so I don't go totally croak while I go and grab some more water, possibly.
Okay.
Sorry, I'm slightly bumped that there.
It's probably extremely loud. You do bump it rather a lot. I wish you wouldn't. This isn't in the document. I think that's been written out wrong. Let me find it here. Interaction. The sixth response is found outside the area of party politics. The strategy of interaction focuses on competition between political parties than on relationships between different groups and the underlying concerns that are driving support for extremist parties. It draws upon decades of research in social psychology and demonstrates how increasing levels of contact between members of different groups can reduce prejudice, counter perceptions of threat, and improve levels of tolerance. This strategy offers one approach through which mainstream parties and other actors in society, such as voluntary and third sector groups, I think he's referring to NGOs basically, yes, there, can support communities to become more resilient in the face of extremism. At the EU level, the potential role for the strategy of integration is recognised through an increased emphasis on the concept of interculturalism led by the Council of Europe.
The same Council of Europe that funded the Becoming a Minority project.
Yes, it's exactly the same stuff. But he's basically endorsing the idea of diffusion propaganda, yeah, from people at the EU.
And there's that last paragraph over there with however. However, an important caveat is needed. Interaction has been shown to be particularly effective when it takes place under certain conditions. Groups should have equal status, work towards a common goal, experience substantive interaction, and have the support of the authorities. If the strategy is to be effective, then it must not rely simply on snapshot interventions, such as a one-day festival. Inviting members of different communities to self-select in a snapshot event is unlikely to have a positive and longer-term impact on community relations. On the contrary, these superficial forms of interaction may have adverse effects by confirming suspicions and fueling tensions. If it is to have positive effects, then this response strategy needs to be geared towards building sustainable and meaningful forms of interaction between different groups.
They talk about the Nascent Left Party adopted the strategy of principle and fought the good fight for permissive immigration and integration policies. While the strategy of principle was often the initial response, over the longer term it is unlikely to work when the other parties in the system, notably centre-right parties, move towards the strategy of adoption. Similarly, while attempts to diffuse the appeal of PEPs were in some cases an effective preemptive strategy, ultimately its effectiveness depended on the actions of other mainstream parties and whether they remained committed to pursuing this approach. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge, movers, hegemony. This suggests that the effectiveness of any particular strategy will depend heavily on whether it is employed by one or several mainstream parties. Meanwhile, the parties on the centre-left decided to shift towards the strategy of adoption. The result was often internal disputes that undermined credibility. One example was Denmark, where the initial attempt by the Social Democrats to defuse immigration failed. A subsequent shift to the strategy of adoption resulted in internal disputes and brought little electoral benefit. So the person must be credible. They must be coming from the right audience segment in terms of, you know, viewership. they must, you know, they basically are saying, look, if you're going to pretend to do this, make it credible. It has to come from quote-unquote existing right-wing voices.
Look at that next paragraph you've got there as well. The contrast with the Dutch experience, where a shift towards more restrictive policies preempted the arrival of populist extremists. However, to the attempt to diffuse the issue and growing public concern over immigration failed, not least because mainstream parties focused heavily on the economic dimension. This left space for populist extremists who instead geared their exclusionary campaigns to exploiting public perceptions that immigrants and Muslim communities were threatening Dutch culture and its accompanying tradition of tolerance. Now, again, there's that thing that he's pointed out, that by not coming in, completely dominating the narrative,
by not
dominating the space, there was a gap whereby people who actually appealed to what the public felt became a problem.
Well, it's outlined in earlier chapters, it is cultural rather than economic dimensions that is crucial to understanding the support for populist extremist parties, which very much mirrors what we saw in subsequent MI5 documents, which talk about cultural nationalism as the biggest threat, in quotes, from right-wing extremism.
I mean, I have no other bits I've picked out of this. I just want to mention that this, to me, reads like a more complex and well-thought-out version of the Centre for Policy Exchange study we read that included a lot of research from Brendan Cox, Joe Cox's husband, or ex-husband, I should say. And it's, again, this is just another example of all these people all revolving around the same spheres physically, all saying the same thing, all being part of the same messaging, and I think we've essentially found one of the root causes.
This is like document zero. This is them basically going out and saying, we're going to fill your entire space. The thing is, they're doing all of this. They're basically talking about changing track, talking about how to fill the space. The fact they're not going to disappear, but what they need to do is they need to use a lot of these strategies in conjunction. And what he's really saying is that all the parties need to collude together, not to solve the issues that people want solving, but to crowd out the voices of those saying that these are an issue. This is a strategy for denying problems and denying populations responses to problems in a political way. It is one of the dirtiest documents I've seen, because it is primarily a gaslighting manual.
Yeah, we can maybe go to that last paragraph you're hovering over there before we finish on this.
Okay.
The simple realities of European politics indicate that populist extremist parties are unlikely to disappear from the landscape. Rather, the underlying and deeper trends that have fueled their rise look set to continue over the coming decades.
Yeah.
Public concern over immigration and rising cultural and ethnic diversity, anxiety over the presence and compatibility of Muslims, and dissatisfaction with the performance of mainstream elites on these issues are unlikely to subside. The enduring nature of this challenge is perhaps best reflected and more recent findings that demonstrate how PEPs are not the exclusive property of older generations. There is evidence that those who vote for populist extremist parties, like voters more generally, are also influencing the voting habits of their children. This future potential is similarly underscored by the finding that 37% of people who support FN leader Marine Le Pen in France come from those aged under 35, or by the youthful working class demographic of the EDL support. If politicians and policymakers are to meet this challenge, they need to radically rethink their current understanding of and approaches to populist extremism. This report is intended as step one in that process.
There's a lot of stuff in here about basically becoming infiltrators, filling the space, lying to people. I mean, this bit here, where he basically comes up with the... Oh, that's not the engagement stuff, sorry. It's the... It's the little paragraph where he's... Oh, I can't find it now. God damn it. Conclusion. I guess he brings in more charts here, but still. Engagement. There's a lot more in here. The adoption bit, sorry.
Yes.
The way he basically just talks about the... arguing that migration must be limited, multiculturalism tempered by an increased emphasis on what some call integration, but others label assimilation. That done, politics... politics can get back to normal. Such a dirty line there. Such a dirty line. And basically, that's what he's doing. Again, Tory insider, Tory minister, or Tory appointee, at least, who wrote a document about building up a facade and then eating up the space of what he refers to as populist extremists, which are just any alternative political movement.
Yes.
This could be applied to any alternative political movement. It is a document for maintaining Tory and Labour hegemony.
Yes, and really to sum it up here, it is our belief that many of the actors and organisations we have covered over the last three streams, but the two before in this yes. one, are part of an organised effort to control the narrative on right-wing issues and police or subvert any outlying extremists. And that's why we have something like what we've got up screen here, the National Conservatism Conference.
Yes.
An idea that seemed to get brewed up in... One place told me it was 2016, post-Brexit, that this idea for this conference first came up. But anywhere else on their website, it says it's 2017, well, if not you later.
Pretty much... Everybody within the National Conservative Conference is associated with one of these outfits.
Should we have a little scroll through?
Yes.
It's a sort of rogues gallery.
Yeah.
So, sitting MP, Henry Jackson Society, sitting MP, Kevin Roberts is, I think he works for a number, I think it's either Heritage Foundation or a number of American think tanks, sitting US Senator, no idea who that guy is, weird mixed race woman that's trying to be like tough on schools. I mean, we could go through.
Is the deputy chairman of the Conservative Party, so sitting MP.
Yeah, we could go through all these people. There are folk in here who are supposed to be based, and as far as I can tell, are based to some extent, but they have been roped into this. Theodore Dalrymple, you've got more MPs, Yoram Hazeny. I'm not even going to say anything other than just say that guy's name. there's Amandeep Bogal. And all these, I think if we scroll down further here, there's Matthew Goodwin. There's yes. Henry George, who was part of Mallard and is now part of all sorts of other groups. There's Madeline Grant, that I think was either Policy Exchange or Henry Jackson. There's Mary Harrington, TERF in chief.
There's Darren Grimes, yeah, whose main crime is being Darren Grimes.
Yes, there's that Alex Kushuta bird that everyone tells me is based. Eric Kaufman, who again I'm told is based, but as far as I can tell, just spent a lot of time working with Matthew Goodwin on things. And then down here at the bottom, oh, there's Emma Webb from the Henry Jackson Society. And there's David Starkey, who seems to only have his position on the right now because he basically groveled and apologised for saying the wrong things about slavery. Ed West, who I believe writes for the Mallard. And then Toby Young of the...
Substack.
Oh, what would you call it? Free Speech Union.
Well, it's kind of a who's who of policy people, fake-based.
But the thing I know as well, I know for a fact that the people we know, and we are not even one degree away from, people we genuinely know, were offered passes to this and press passes.
Yeah.
Now, some of those people were wise enough to know not to take those. And did not go to this conference. However, certain people from the Mallard, certain people from Lotus Eaters, certain people from a whole host of other edgy, new, you know, cutting edge right-wing outlets, they all went. And they all seemed to have a grand old time because they were being appeased to.
It's the who's who of the acceptable E-right, but it's the who's who of the acceptable E-right because they all belong to one of these organisations.
Or at least the vast majority do.
Yes. Or are they at least are affiliated with them in some way. Yes. Or have handlers, basically, who come from this organisation. That's why we were so incensed by this National Conservatism thing. It's very much an operation to, on a surface level, adopt the talking points that are being screamed out from every pub in Britain. Every pub in Britain is full of people who agree with us, effectively. Who agree with what we want. And want Britain to be a country again. Want... the nationalities, the constituent parts of England, Wales, Ireland, and Scotland to have their own national identities and their own national ethnicities.
Yeah. I mean, we could go through their statement of principles, but I honestly can't be bothered. And also, don't I have to scroll down there and see Paul Gottfried's name again when I saw that earlier, which worried me.
A lot of people get roped into this, but the main figures, the main heads, the people who are guiding the supposedly insurgent, somebody even used the word vanguard to describe it, movement.
We'll get to that in a second.
All parts of the British establishment who are putting forth all of this anti-right-wing content, who are these de-radicalization experts who are very obviously trying to, what Morgoth would refer to as, cool off the mark.
Yes, I mean, I frame it this way. I can only see this logically, because we know it's not an emergent phenomenon. There is no such thing.
Yeah.
As an explicit operation managed most likely from the Home Office itself to paint itself and the party around it as cutting edge. It's the perfect combo of heel manufacturing caked in de-radicalisation messages.
Yes.
You'll find the National Conservative Conference riddled with people directly from the failed Tory party. And it's supposed to be dissident against that. And the security state that ruthlessly patrols the acceptable edge of Tory thought to paint those who stray past it as extremists.
Yes.
We can go as well to what I thought was an interesting article that someone had written about it.
I remember that, what you said, liberals get the bullet too. Yes, the principal of Nova Scotia did say that one of the reasons they closed down public gatherings was to stop the spread of information. Like, they actually just said that.
God.
But anyway.
People are like, Will Chamberlain, Rod Dreher, oh no. But this is one that got me. So from the American Conservative, written by one Dr. S. Matra, or whatever his name was. Now, somebody put me on to him about 2 years ago because, like, oh, he's a bit of a right-wing Lenin guy. But I'm not so sure anymore because I don't understand how you can call sitting MPs who have sat on their hands for over a decade on immigration policy a reactionary vanguard.
No. Suddenly, members of the Conservative Party who have been, the most generous interpretation you can give is that they have been asleep at the wheel.
Yes.
Through all of this.
Now, we could read through the whole of this article. There's just one paragraph I really want to go over, which is one that sort of frames it all so kind of perfectly. But it should be obvious to anyone that's au fait with anything we're doing here that there is no such thing as a reactionary vanguard in the Conservative Party. The only thing that is a vanguard within that organisation is that it is a vanguard of its own interests.
Yes, it is. I forget, thank you for the £2, Spurg Media, says Roundhouse Kicker Glowy today. good content, thank you for the £2. I will remind people at this point in the stream, if you do want to have your questions answered or you do want to donate, there is a link in the pinned message. But just letting people know, there's a lot of you guys have been quite generous off-air through the Ko-Fi. I know we mentioned it last week, but yes, thank you. Thank you, people who have also donated anonymously to the PayPal as well, because I've seen a couple of you guys do that too. I should get that done before I forget anyway. Anyway, continue.
Well, no, if you don't mind going to the notes and grabbing the paragraph that I'm after.
Yeah, sure.
It's the one that starts with, also remarkable.
Yes, I will grab that and make sure I'm not in the wrong section.
I would recommend, honestly, people go give this article a read, because some of the simpering stuff in here is actually hilarious.
Here you go. I'll put this in the chat as well. But also, if you guys are watching the VOD, notes down below.
Yes, of course, as always.
As always, notes in the pinned comment.
Also remarkable was the number of Twitter sophisticates deliberately obfuscating the National Conservative Conference, a venue and platform for debate, with the National Conservative ethos and movement a somewhat new but increasingly coherent ideology proposing a national identity opposed to racial essentialism of all forms in favour of values and geography, a pro-family economy, social organisation rooted in order, merit and hierarchy, and non-interventionism and balance of power abroad. It is the new right that is dissident, falling in love with ideas and debating data about crimes, school, and thought criminal and school system. Again, this is just a fucking lie. Because he's like, it's non-interventionism. But somewhere in the bloody statement of principles for the National Conservatism Conference, our group that it's based on, they're like, we implore people move towards the development of essentially arms and technology so that we do not get run roughshod by China and Russia. So they're quite clearly not non-interventionists.
Again, what they're saying is boilerplate meant to appeal to us, but the people involved had a record of basically behind the scenes, as we talked about last week and the week before, being these anti-radicalization people, these MI5 insiders and Home Office funded insiders in many cases. Or they've just written a document that says, yes, you should go out there and fill the dialectic space of the populist voices, of the dissident voices, and in doing so you should lie to people and create normality again by pretending you've already sorted the issue, or that you should go and engage with them and make sure that this engagement only happens under extremely tightly controlled circumstances where people can't actually just realize that they have nothing in common with each other.
Yeah, and we can go to the final sort of thing we've got as a source this evening, which is a single tweet from Matt Godwin that I think is almost him tipping his hand. You know, Elon makes the tweet that traditional media have used the term far right so frequently and hyperbolically that it no longer means anything. And Matt Godwin, of course, comes along as the ultimate reply guy and says, I agree. Not only is the term far-right so vague to be meaningless, but it's been stretched so far to encompass everybody who challenges the socially liberal elite consensus, like the BBC police below, which casually throws in Boris Johnson among far-right. Now, I can only view this above tweet as the central objective of so many of these people from the Henry Jackson Society, Policy Exchange, Chatham House, and all the media people signal boosting their research and specific elements of terminology. They want to re-engineer and reinterpret the right-wing space in an effort to give credence to the Tory party again so it can continue to be resilient in the face of populism and extremism and cut any space away for these populist extremist parties, which also includes us, the dissident organisation. Across media and government and even into the security state, there has been a consistent line of tackling this one issue, and otherwise ignorant people in our sphere have welcomed them in to help with their operation. This has to stop now.
You are allowing into this people who are from, again, I don't know, people just don't seem to know what Chatham House is, who are from, like I said, the UK version of the Council for Foreign Relations, who are from the Conservative Party, who are from the Home Office, who are from the Gates Foundation, who are from all of these places, who are from any of these kind of direct tenders. And there's many more than this. These are just the ones we've talked about recently. And again, this is how they manufacture experts.
Yes.
This is how they manufacture people who they think, quote unquote, should be taken seriously. You can have someone who is a complete dribbler, who is just reciting policy points. To his credit, I don't think Matt Godwin is somebody who is an intelligent. I think he's very intelligent and has done a lot of work using his own research earlier in life to basically break into this space with many other people using these strategies. And you cannot trust someone who spent the first like 10 years of their career going around and saying, you are evil, we will destroy you by drowning you out, by any means necessary, we will not sort the issues that are important to you, because keeping the major political parties in power and framing anyone else...
Is that frozen on the screen, or is that...
No, that is just way behind YouTube.
All right.
And who is interested in... I've completely lost my train of thought now.
Well, what I was going to say is that I think we could close this stream off with essentially a call to arms. You see any of these people being signal boosted by anyone that supposedly purports themselves as friends, step in and please, like, actually correct the record.
Yeah, that's...
Because I won't stand for this anymore. And if in a year's time we have to still share this space with people like Matt Godwin and all the other based sprogs that are being moulded in his image, quite frankly, I'm done.
It should not be hard to cut out the Tory boy cancer.
No.
It should not be hard to say the Conservative Party has proved itself as an existential enemy of the British populace, and those who are involved in it will not be given a voice in this space.
No.
His involvement with the Tory Party alone should preclude Matt Godwin from appearing on your TV screens or on your phone screens, if you are specifically trying to engage with alternative content, if you specifically do not want to hear from the Tory party, and yet you have to via the Henry Jackson yeah. Society, you have to via Policy Exchange, and you have to via people like Matt Goodwin or Unheard or Tim Montgomery or any of these tendrils. And it is such a low bar. We can just stop doing it. We can just say, oh, you're a senior fellow at Policy Exchange. You mean the Policy Exchange that did this, that, and the other? You know, the Policy Exchange that took money from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation? The Policy Exchange that extolled the virtues of the Conservative Party lurching leftwards? Oh, you mean the Policy Exchange that is just an extension of the Conservative Party? That Policy Exchange? It's just all so obvious. It's all so out in the open, and yet these people remain in our midst. They yeah. remain in our feeds. They remain in our minds. They remain in our circles. And saying that they shouldn't be here is somehow controversial.
Yeah, again, someone in the chat said, can't they just provide good recruitment space?
No. No.
Because you cannot subvert the Tory party, and the process of doing so, the Tory party will adopt and subvert you.
These people...
And again, I don't want to... Neither of us want to do this because we wish to poke fun at people or start drama. We know who the people are that have had... You know, Matt Godwin, Calvin Robinson, and this, that, the next person on their show, be it Carl at Lotus Eaters, or the New Culture Forum people, or the National Conservatism Conference, or the Mallard Magazine,
or
whoever
GB News,
it is.
Yeah.
If these people want to come to us so that they can be provided with the research we have done into the people, they should quite frankly be background checking before putting them on their own shows. I will happily provide that stuff to them. But half of these people want to pretend like I don't exist. So for the time being, this is the best that we've got. Now, I'm going to probably send the notes for this stream as well off to some folk so that they are aware of, especially this one individual, because I think Matt Godwin just, he should not be allowed to go anywhere online without being harassed.
His whole strategy, writing a policy document that involves exactly what he's doing as a strategy for delegitimizing and routing anything to the right of the Tory party is just extraordinary. It is egregious. And the fact that he's not, like, waved in his face every time he appears is disturbing, because it means that we do not have the ability. We made a stream called The Virtues of Gatekeeping, made a stream with Panama Hat called Knowing Who Your Friends Are, and we didn't think we'd have to start going out and naming names. We thought people would get it. But here we are. Stop doing it. That's all I can say. Stop. You can just stop doing it. I think we've got kind of got to the end of it there.
But yes,
we do have some more promotion to do. We do have regular things going up on the Substack. So if you are interested in our written content, do subscribe to Substack. There will be weekly content there. You just put out your First of the Mantras for Surviving Modernity. We'll be doing written forms of those. That'll be going out on a Thursday, basically for the foreseeable future.
I will try to at least.
There will be another upload on the YouTube channel tomorrow. I've managed to sort it. It will be quite a long one. I'll be uploading my Technocrats piece. You've probably noticed the videos tab is a bit better populated now. I did Permissible Activism, then I did Barking at the Headlines. You guys seem to like those quite a lot. Those two are kind of related to each other as pieces, but again, those are 2 years old now. Those are two-year-old pieces of written content I've turned into videos, and I don't know, they're still as fresh as ever. They don't really date themselves, and I tried to make them not date themselves, but there is a lot more of us coming up, so do watch out. Like I said, ideally, we have a stream on Monday, a video of some kind that goes up on Tuesday, a stream on Wednesday, and something on the Substack on Thursday, and Friday, Saturday, Sunday is obviously party time, so we leave you guys to go to the pub, because your mission on a Friday, a Saturday, and Sunday is not to engage with our content, it is to be in the pub.
Yes, because honestly, going to the pub and engaging with real people is about all there's really left out there. So enjoy it while it bloody well lasts.
Yes, it's Friday. I do my religious get to the pub posts. So you want to see those.
Bonus points if you drink a Theakston's pint of mild.
that is the dissident drink of choice. No, not related in any way. Oh, dear me. But yeah, apart from that, again, do support us if you feel like you would want to. Do interact with our videos, likes, shares, comments, all that stuff. The algorithm does sometimes need satisfying.
It does. We're afraid.
So we will satisfy the algorithm.
I shan't subject people to more of me croaking away, so I will say good night.
Yes, and a good night from me as well. Good night, guys.
And we'll see you on Wednesday.
See you Wednesday. Bye.